I'm speaking with Earl Lum at the conclusion of the International Microwave Symposium in Boston for 2019. And Earl, it's been a very full 3 days, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's been packed with a lot of meetings, lots of conversations, running into old friends, meeting and making new friends here. And it's been a very, very productive week, and a lot of questions have been answered, at least from my perspective in coming here. So I'm glad that I'm here in Boston.
Good. Well, let's rewind the tape a little bit. The last time I think you and I did a podcast like this, you had spent the holiday season trekking around Sacramento counting Verizon 28 gigahertz sites. And I think since then you've done the same thing in LA and then Minneapolis. So what did you learn from that additional data?
I've learned that Minneapolis is very cold in April. I've also learned that the total number of sites has not substantially increased at all in these quote-unquote mobile 5G launches that Verizon has done, which continues to make me feel somewhat skeptical and concerned about the breadth of deployment capabilities that Verizon has in able to provide some level of coverage across every city that they intend to launch, across the downtown areas, and to be able to have, a good sense of quality of service to those initial 5G mobile users that are going to be on their network.
Are you hearing any feedback from actual users as how they're finding the service, assuming they can get the service?
The only anecdotal information I've seen is everyone loves it because they're the only ones on the network. So like a cable modem, as more and more people get on board, I think they're going to see those greater than 1 gigabit per second data rates start to drop off.
So when you and I talked before, you were concerned about what you saw in Sacramento. It sounds like you have those same concerns now based on this additional data.
Based upon the mobile 5G deployment of Minneapolis as opposed to the fixed 5G deployments in Los Angeles and Sacramento, I was hoping for more coverage and more cells to be deployed in Minneapolis, and that was a disappointment to not see that, given the fanfare of both Chicago and Minneapolis being deployed.
So more recently, we've seen an announcement from Sprint about their 5G launch, which is interesting. At least from a financial perspective, subscriber perspective, they seem to be the lowest one on the totem pole, so to speak, in terms of health. But it seems like this 5G play for them at 2.5 gigahertz might be really a strength. What do you think about that?
Absolutely, I think they are certainly the only ones right now with mid-band spectrum, and the way they're deploying their 64T, 64R massive MIMO systems, it's not just solely on 5G. They're taking half of the elements and supporting 4G for the existing subscribers, and they're taking half of the panel and actually sending out 5G beams. You can't do that in millimeter wave right now. So from Sprint's perspective, they have a dual mode system that they're deploying. So as more and more 5G traffic is required, that massive MIMO antenna will then start to shift its capacity over into 5G and less in supporting 4G.
So do you think they have the, and of course we're dealing with the uncertainty of the T-Mobile-Sprint merger, but do you think they have the capital depth that they could actually, without T-Mobile, deploy this and gain some traction with subscribers?
I think right now, realistically, they have enough capital depth to get their initial deployments done. If they don't get this merger through with T-Mobile, it's unlikely they could actually blanket the U.S. with their 5G coverage, given the amount of money that's going to be required that's probably not going to be available from SoftBank.
So with respect to the merger, I guess the FCC, or at least three members of the FCC, have indicated they would support it, but we hear the Department of Justice has some concerns. What's your sense of will this thing go through or not?
Part of the issue that I'm concerned about with the DOJ perspective is this notion that there needs to be still a fourth wireless carrier. Who would that be? How would that come about? That's independent of, I think, the prepaid divestment of Boost Mobile that Amazon is supposedly interested in. So having four mobile operators to be competitive in the U.S. seems like a challenge at this point, and I think it'd be easy for T-Mobile and Sprint to divest Boost, but they actually give up a big chunk of the 2.5 gigahertz spectrum to enable someone else. Seems like that would be a hard sell, and that would take out a lot of the whole reason for having the merger in the first place.
So how do you regard U.S. Cellular? Because they're kind of maybe a distant fifth in the market today, but I noticed they actually won, what was it, some 24 gigahertz spectrum.
I think U.S. Cellular is the last regional guy in the U.S. So given their footprint right now, given that they had acquired 600 megahertz spectrum and other low-band spectrum, and the fact that they don't have any mid-band spectrum and they would need to have microwave spectrum as well to fill things out for their 5G ambitions, it was a foregone conclusion that they were going to get some 24 gig either in the existing markets that they have today or in new markets where they would want to expand the services. The question is can U.S. Cellular become the fourth nationwide operator is the question, and can they get enough, do they have enough capital to actually roll out across New York and L.A. and all the other markets where they're not currently in to become a viable number four carrier in the U.S. is certainly unknown at this point, and I'm not sure if that's part of their aspirations at the corporate level.
So I guess we'll see. Time will tell us the answer to that.
Absolutely. I think Amazon could certainly do more damage by buying Boost, but they wouldn't have a network. So then the question would be, would they be looking at Dish? Possibly, but if they wanted to do their drones or whatever, the 600 megahertz spectrum would be good from Dish, but all the other spectrum is not that great. And so it really doesn't buy you much, in my opinion. So for Amazon to be a number four and actually have a network, they would have to get enough spectrum somewhere to be able to do that, you know, reliably.
So they certainly have the financial wherewithal to do that, but it sounds like a pretty big stretch in terms of practicality.
I think it is at this point. And if they're going to do anything with their drone strategy, it'd be easier to just piggyback off of one of the existing carriers and to do it that way than to try to deploy 10, 20,000 sites somewhere across the U.S. and start building that out.
The other option, I guess, that T-Mobile and Sprint have is to actually go to court and argue against the DOJ, and they might win.
Certainly there's a possibility that they might win, and I think that it's still up in the air right now, but it seems like at least the DOJ is willing to listen, assuming that there is some divestiture, as opposed to just saying no. So there is some wiggle room right now, but again, we'll have to wait and see when everything is said and done. But certainly the FCC, I think that was pretty obvious that they were not going to go against the deal. So the real question was always, what would the DOJ do? And given what happened with them trying to battle AT&T and Time Warner and not winning on that one,
right?
Maybe they will eventually want to back off, but just get some concessions out of Sprint and T-Mobile.
The other major news that we've watched over the last month or so has been this ban on exports to Huawei. And Qorvo came out pretty quickly and said that this quarter that would have a $50 million impact. And then this week's Skyworks came out and kind of on a midpoint guidance standpoint reduced their forecast by $60 million. So we're looking at two players with over a $100 million impact. What do you think is going to happen with this Huawei ban?
I think the ZTE ban, if we go back and roll back the time for when that occurred and how the Chinese government got involved, I think they were upset about it, but I think they weren't going to do too much to rattle and rock the boat because it was ZTE. Now that you've attacked the crown jewel of the Chinese industry with Huawei, it's bringing the Chinese government into a situation where they're digging a trench and they're going to wait it out, and it'll be a war of attrition. And I think that's bad news for everyone that we've gone to this level. I think it also puts into question the whole viability of Taiwan being a rogue province as opposed to being an official province, given the that both Wynn and TSMC are domiciled on that island for compound semis and for silicon processes. So there's a lot of other things that are starting to impact this whole trade dispute between the United States and China. And now that we've essentially are trying to cut the legs off of Huawei and the arms as well, it's not a surprise that there's going to be billions of dollars of financial impact for all parties, specifically in the United States, whether it's semiconductors, whether it's components, board material, solder, metals, whatever is out there that, you know, companies that were on the exhibition floor this week are not going to be shipping for at least the next quarter, maybe two quarters, and maybe from the looks of it, could be a year or beyond a year. And I think at this point, the real question is with the latest information coming out of Asia that Huawei is cutting back component orders because they may not have everything to be able to make their handsets, is their handset group going to suffer dramatically because of this ban as opposed to their infrastructure group?
There was some immediate impact, I think, recalling the ZTE ban that ZTE had really crippled. But it seemed like Huawei did some stockpiling of orders. Is that your sense, so that they at least have a little bit of runway?
I think they stockpiled a lot of parts, but you have to remember that for any system that they're building, there are thousands of different components and SKU numbers on those boards. And if they were able to stockpile every one of those parts, how many months they have of each one of those. I think there's been a lot of stories about the FPGAs and the converters and maybe the amplifiers having a stockpiled time frame of 12 to 18 months. But my gut feeling tells me that there's some other things that are flowing around out there that they clearly don't have enough pieces of. And certainly from the latest information on the handset side, with them cutting orders and shutting down potentially production lines on the phones, that they clearly didn't stockpile enough parts on the phones.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a couple different issues with them. One is they've been accused of, like ZTE was, selling parts illegally to Iran and maybe North Korea. And then, of course, there's the whole security issue where people are concerned about data getting piped back to China. It seems to me that at least one solution they could have to the first problem is if they fessed up to violating export laws and do like ZTE did, pay a big fine.
Absolutely, and I think that part of it is probably the easiest thing to do, but we are dealing with a culture that does not like to admit that or be embarrassed on an international stage, and I think we have clearly done that in this instance, so it makes it harder for them to fess up and to admit to that. And on top of that, I think there's a much more aggressive stance that we're taking against Huawei that maybe we didn't have against ZTE last year.
Right. They seem to be doing quite a PR campaign in the rest of the world, even in the U.S., by suing the U.S. government to try to argue their case.
Absolutely. I think that their PR people are not sleeping at all anywhere around the world, and they're running 24/7 at this point to try to discuss the issues at hand, but maybe they're blowing in the wind at this point with all of that. I think Europe has decided that, you know, they could take some of the equipment on the RAN side. It's not going to be a problem. I think on the core network side of it, certainly that remains something where the Europeans don't necessarily want to touch that, and they'll stick with Huawei in the RAN. And again, at the end of the day, this whole security issue, my personal feeling is you take a bunch of equipment and you send it to the Israelis, and if they don't find anything, then maybe there's nothing there.
You're good. Well, it's hard to predict what the president will do, but do you see this getting resolved some way as part of a larger U.S.-China trade deal?
We're still at least a month away, I think, from the next meeting between the U.S. and China, and the rhetoric seems to be diverging as opposed to converging at this point. So I'm not sure how well that meeting is going to go when they actually meet face-to-face, and if there are going to be some conciliatory remarks that are going to be made, or if it's going to be a situation where no one even shows up at the table because we're so far apart in terms of negotiations right now that the Chinese are not willing to admit to anything. They have said that they will sign a no-spying agreement, but since their equipment's not in the U.S., that's not going to be practical.
Right.
There's two different issues at hand. There's the international issue on the spying side, and then there's a localized U.S. issue of violating and selling to Iran and North Korea or Syria or wherever else that they might have sold to. So those are being lumped together at this point, and it's creating a much bigger issue that I don't think we're inching closer towards each other, but more likely to be further away, given the latest rhetoric on rare earth metals exporting and some other things that the Chinese government itself, that's not Huawei saying it, it's the Chinese government saying it, and this didn't happen the last go-around with ZTE.
Well, this week was very upbeat here at IMS. Let's hope that this broader issue doesn't throw the industry into a recession.
I think right now the guys that really have to worry are the operators that have a substantial amount of their core and RAN from Huawei today, or maybe even sole source to Huawei, depending on who that operator is and what region. They are probably able to wait it out for a couple of quarters and not worry. But if it lasts for more than a couple of quarters, and we're definitely well into 2020, I think those operators are going to have to make a very tough decision. Is this situation going to be resolved? And if it doesn't, then who are my backup? What's my backup plan? And who do I go with on my backup plan with regard to ZTE as an alternative to Huawei, or to Ericsson, or to Nokia, or Samsung? I think those are going to be some very hard decisions that these operators will need to make.
As I recall, when we talked last time, you said that the internal market for Huawei was great, that they could do very well just supplying into China, but of course we weren't considering that they would have an export ban that would prevent them from shipping anything. So if at least the export ban got alleviated, they could maybe serve their internal market. And now China's officially, I guess, launching their 5G with official licenses now.
Absolutely. With the fourth China broadcast actually getting a license as well. Whether or not they do anything with it is a different story. But all four companies were able to get licenses from the Chinese government this week. And certainly that's been pulled in, because the original time frame, I think, was probably going to be Q1 of 2020. Now we are pulling it in at least several quarters ahead of this. And the question then becomes, are there enough components and parts and systems to be able to roll out into the cities and actually do the deployments that the three real operators over there are planning on doing? And then subsequently, will there be handsets available actually that right. will be able to support all of the network gear that's going out?
Right. Let's come back now to IMS, which is, well, not the technical stuff, but the exhibition closed today. What are your takeaways from this week in Boston?
I saw some very interesting new areas of growth for the industry that I think were on the fringe and bubbling up, but now seem to be certainly in a ramp. One which was SATCOM, in the SATCOM market with all the LEO satellite constellations and the activity surrounding that. That was certainly very good for, I think, a lot of the vendors and exhibitors on the floor this week in terms of the feedback and talking to them. From a technology perspective, Diamond seemed to be now finally gaining some momentum and being not just so esoteric on the fringe, but with actually devices and with a packaging that seems to be not so expensive that no one's thinking about using them. And given everything that was talked about this week, power density, thermal density, everything relating to getting heat and power out of a package and out of the die is at the forefront of every designer's mind right now. So talking to looking at Diamond, looking at any other material that's going to get the heat out and spread the heat is going to be critical going forward for all the designers of any of these systems.
One of the things that surprised me a bit this week is the number of companies like NXP and Amplion that are really focused on LDMOS for the massive MIMO sub-6 gigahertz bands up to like 4 gigahertz, and some pretty highly integrated front-end modules that they're putting out for that market.
I think we've been talking about GaN for a while now because we didn't know where the latest gen of LDMOS was going to be. Certainly that answer is now out there from both Amplion and NXP, and I think it looks like it's business as usual as to whatever was going on in 4G will now be the same for 5G, at least for their perspective on LDMOS, up to a certain power level. So I think at some point there'll be a transition above a certain power level, depending on which vendor you're talking to where they will probably say, you're better off doing GaN than you are doing LDMOS. But there also is a situation where there are GaN equivalent parts for every one of those LDMOS parts.
Right.
They don't come free. They're not at parity. And I think the feedback is we would like that efficiency, but we don't want to pay for it.
Right. I guess the other area that would give GaN an advantage is for wider band amplifier that covers multiple cellular bands.
Yeah, I think when you start looking at 400 megahertz bandwidths for band 3 up to band 1, then maybe there's an opportunity for GaN to play in that marketplace because the power levels are still very, very high. We're still looking at 50, 80 watt and up transistor power levels. We're LDMOS at that point. You may start to have efficiency issues at 3.5 gigahertz to where you might want to choose a different technology. But again, I think it's ultimately going to come down to how much am I willing to pay to get the extra efficiency or the bandwidth, and am I willing to pay it or not to get which technology for my system.
Well, it's been a big week. Earl, thank you for spending a few minutes at the end of it when I think we're both pretty close to brain dead.
Yeah, well, thank you, Gary, and thanks for Microwave Journal hosting at the City Tap Bar as well on Tuesday evening. So, appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you.